If I had my life to live over again, I would live it to change the life of people. Because I believe you have not done anything significant until you have become an instrument in the hands of God to change people. As I understand the Word of God, there are only two things God is going to take off of this planet. One is His Word, and the other is people. And if you want to invest in something that will outlast you, then spend more of your time building His Word into people. In this hour, I would like to engage in some synthesizing for you, distilling some principles. We began the first night with a mandate. Jesus Christ, the risen head of the church, has called us to make disciples. And we have been endeavoring to explicate what's involved in that process. And now I'd like to bring this together in terms of nine principles that I would encourage you to see as yardsticks by which to measure what you are doing. Bear in mind, you need to die for a principle, not a method. Methods vary. Principles never change. No matter what the time, what the culture, what the circumstances may be. The first principle that I would suggest is that you begin with an agonizing appraisal of your life and ministry. Begin with an agonizing appraisal of your life and ministry. Begin with evaluation, not action. I had a prominent businessman in my office some years ago. He said, "Hendricks, I put my money on a dead horse. I spent all of my life climbing the ladder of success only to discover that when I got to the top, my ladder was leaning against the wrong wall." And I thought, that is the tragedy of many people in the ministry. Martin Lloyd-Jones, in my judgment, one of the great preachers of our time, made an honest statement which only a secure person could make. At the end of his ministry, he said, "I built a crowd, but I did not build a church." And I say the time when you need some serious assessment of your ministry is right now, en route, so that you don't get to the end of the trolley line and discover that your ladder was leaning against the wrong wall. To me, there are four biggies that I would like to share with you that I think are the essence of life at any level. You first of all begin with objectives. Objectives determine outcomes. You achieve that for which you aim. And failure in ministry does not result from overwork. It results from fogginess of objective. You've got to ask the question, what do I want? What will really give me fulfillment at the end of my ministry? And of course, to the committed Christian, what you want is hopefully spelled out for you in the inscripturated writings of the Word of God. God has spoken, He has not stuttered. And my task is to discover, Lord, what do you want me to do? Ministry is not doing your thing, it's doing His thing. And when Jesus Christ commands, make disciples, I have no other option. But objectives must always lead to priorities. You've got to prioritize what you want to do. You cannot do everything. Everybody makes decisions, no exceptions. So I've got to make decisions concerning how badly do I want to accomplish that objective. See, most of us, if I ask you to give me a set of your objectives, would write down a pretty impressive list. But you don't want them badly enough to pay the price tag. See, I have students say to me all the time, Prof, I'd give anything if I could communicate like you do. I say, no, you wouldn't. You have no idea of the price tag you pay. Why, you'd have to give up all kinds of stuff to pull off that objective. In the last hour, beautiful. What a climax to see Ray and his dear wife here. And you sit there, you know, like any intelligent person and say, man, I'd love to have a relationship like that. But you wouldn't be willing to pay the price tag that that couple has paid. The third one has to do with schedule. Now, to most people, a schedule is a demon chaperone. It comes along and sort of slaps your fingers every now. Up, watch it. No, a schedule is simply a tool to help you keep your priorities and accomplish your objectives. This student walks into my office and says, Prof, I want to be a man of God. Fantastic. I'm glad to hear that. Let's write that down. I don't think anybody will give you gas on that. Now, precisely what does that mean? What do you think it means to be a man of God? What does a man of God look like? Well, yeah. He'd be a man of the word. Fantastic. Let's put that down. You want to be a man of the word? You really want to be a man of the word? Oh, yeah. So let me see your schedule. Well, what schedule? Don't you have a schedule? No. Yeah, you do. No, I don't. You do. It's probably a lousy one. But you got one. So, you know, finally comes up with this measly piece of paper. I look it over. I say, you know, that fascinates me because there's nothing on that schedule that will guarantee that you will become a man of the word. Say, I want a good marriage. Great. Let me see your schedule. You got it planned in? Time with my baby. See, that does not happen, friend. I do not sit around looking for something to do. I'll clue you. Boy, I got to claw that thing out to make sure. And that's just as sacred to me as my time in the Word of God. Because it's a part of my priority. And I'm under a command to love my wife as Christ loved the church. Man, it's a full-time job. Discovering that? Well, don't look so convicted. Let's go on. Now, fourth, we could have gone on all day without mentioning this. I'm sorry about this. But the fourth concept is discipline. See, that's a dirty word in our culture. And I really believe it after all of these years of working with pastors and Christian workers and missionaries and seminary students, I am convinced that you can separate the men from the boys and the women from the girls in one area. That's discipline. See, that asks and answers the question, what are the dynamics that you have by which to keep on that schedule and those priorities in order to accomplish those objectives. Now we say the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, and so forth. Well, in the and so forth is self-control. I went to a church some time ago. Pastor said to me after we finished the Sunday evening meeting, he said, "Now, Prof, I got to get this across to you because, you know, we got to keep these meetings in time. We don't want them to go over." Okay, I'll try to do that. How long do you want me to speak? Just ring a bell. I'm through. I have been working under bells. Every time one rings, I salivate. I said, "By the way, what time do you want me to get up for breakfast?" "Oh, you know, it's Monday. Sleep in. Take your time." So I'll knock on your door. 11:15. He knocked on my door. And I finally got up enough strength to come. And he said, "Breakfast is ready." I figured, well, you know, it's today. You know why we needed to get out at 8:30? I'll tell you, because the best shows came on at 9:00. And we had to get home so we could see TV. And then the late show. About Thursday of the week, he said to me, "Hey, Prof, can I ask you a question?" I said, "Certainly." He said, "What do you think of my ministry? Got any suggestions for it?" I said, "What ministry?" And we had a fascinating discussion. I kid you not, I came home. Gene said, "How'd the week go?" I said, "Well, it was probably a bummer. Except for one thing, what God did in the life of the pastor, that was worth the whole week." So you don't punch a time clock in ministry. You got to manage your time. And it takes the fruit of the Spirit to make the kinds of decisions you guys have got to make every single day, hundreds of times a day. Now I believe this is the heart of whether you will practice discipleship or not. Is it the objective of your ministry? Is it high enough on your priority list? Do you carve out some time and schedule it? And do you have the discipline to stay with it? The second thing I want to share with you is something I think Ray alluded to in the last hour, very insightfully, I felt. And that is, remember, there are levels of discipleship. There are levels of discipleship. Now, we've got one of the finest audiovisual departments in America, but this is the first mistake they ever made. So if you'll just let me explain this to you, we're going to change it. It's very poor in color, and it's poor in terms of orientation. There are three levels. If you will just reverse these, start out here with curious, then convinced, then committed. You will have what I'd like to share with you. You see, one thing that bothers me, and is an increasing amount of this type of stuff, is that people get so hooked on this in thing called discipleship that they're running around and they're saying, "Look, man, you ready to get into a committed group? You ready to fish your cut bait? You don't come into my group, drop dead." You know, we're hardcore people. I say, yeah, just like Jesus Christ did. Right? Not exactly. I'd like to suggest that you need three levels of discipleship going on all the time. First of all is what I call the discovery level. And by the way, we need much more of this in our evangelical churches. That's why we're not having more people come to Christ. I was in a church this weekend that has 12 discovery Bible studies filled with pagans every Sunday morning, investigating the claims of Jesus Christ. No pressure in the group. Nobody cramming anything down your throat. You can ask any question you want. Nobody laughs at you. The result is a steady stream of people are coming to the Savior. the gospel is still the power of God unto salvation. But you can't have personal evangelism without personal involvement. And I think there are people way out in the fringes, particularly today, who are very interested in examining the claims of Jesus Christ. In fact, I would say to you, in my judgment of 35-some years ministry, I am finding people in our generation are more interested in hearing the gospel than most of us are in sharing it. There is a second level, and that's what I call the Bible study level, and I want to differentiate two levels, because every now and then I hear these put down. We unfortunately make choices where the choices are a bummer. You need two kinds. You need input Bible study. You need involvement Bible study. You need times when somebody's going to teach you. What do you think the purpose of the spiritual gift of teaching is? I'm amazed that people say, well, you know, I don't need anybody else to teach me. It's just the Spirit that teaches me. And I say, well, that's interesting that you should give such high regard to the Spirit teaching you and such low regard to the Spirit teaching other people. And I think one of the great needs we've got right now in our churches, and by the way, that's why some of these churches that have strong Bible teaching centers are growing like the proverbial weed. See, people are tired to go to a place where they come out with both feet firmly planted in midair. They want to know, you know, what does it teach? But then you want to get them involved in it so that they are in the process of discovering it for themselves and growing through that exposure. And then third, and this at the heart, is what I call an accountability group, or what Bob Coleman set forth so clearly for us is getting a group together of 4, 5, 6 people and agreeing on these are the things we are going to commit ourselves to. And by the way, that works best when you don't foist it upon a group of people, but rather it comes up from the group. Then they hang in there much more, because it's their commitment, not yours. Now, I wish I had more time to discuss that, but tempus is fugiting. So let me go on to a third one. And that is recruit as individuals, train as teams. Recruit people as individuals, train them as a team. I remember many years ago when I got so sold out to discipleship, I only thought or thought that there was only one form of discipleship that's one-on-one. And I still think that is a very significant form. In fact, I do not think you can ever pull the job off ultimately until you get some one-on-one. There are some individuals whose needs you will never meet from a pulpit. You will never meet from a group. You will only meet one-on-one. So that's got to go on. But I began a study of the life of Christ, which I've continued to this day. And I discovered there really is not as much of that as we would like to think. Most of what Jesus Christ said to any disciple, he said in the presence of at least a part of the group, and in most cases, the entire group. And I think that the dynamics of a group are the means that God uses to bring about supernatural change. And I just want to throw a few things out for you to study. Study Luke chapter 6. Be sure to put it on a timeline and find out when he picked those men. We discovered the other night in one of our presentations, it was as a result of an entire night spent in prayer. By the way, I challenge you to do that. I have been spending more time in prayer asking God to give me the men he wants me to build into. And I'm getting less failures. You're going to get them. Jesus Christ had one. After an entire night spent in prayer, he had a Judas. And you need to know that. Because someday you're going to get into a situation in which the person in whose life you built the most is the one that's the greatest wipeout. And it tends to total you.
And you think, man, you know,
it's my failure. No, it's not your failure any more than children going over the hill is always the failure of a parent. What a naive concept we are promoting on the body. We got more parents under guilt trips today, and we got more kids running around loose who've never come to grips with the fact that they'll never be able to shove that excuse down God's throat. He's going to say, what did you do with it? You are the responsible. I know your parents were failures and made mistakes. So what else is new? What I want to know is, what did you do with it? And it's a wonderful thing to know that you, my dear brothers in Jesus Christ, are going to have some classic failures. You're going to have some people who are total wipeouts. But there's one other thing that I would encourage you. And by the way, you ought to read the book by A.B. Bruce, The Training of the Twelve. It's a classic, exegetically, as well as in every other way. It'll take you a long time to go through it. I'm now on my 42nd reading. And I don't know of anything that has marked me quite as much. Not the type of thing you want to read, you know, watching the Broncos play and having a box of candy and doing some babysitting for your wife. It's the type of thing I read a paragraph and it takes me 6 weeks to track it down. That's why I know when I have a good book by how long it takes me to get through. You need to read the section that he gives on the choosing of the 12. It'll blow your mind. Did you ever look at the collection he's got? How would you like to work with him in your church? How'd you like to have him on your board? One guy hollered out, I got him. Man, you got a radical, you got a redneck. You got some guys in that thing that never peep. I dare you to find out what they say. And you got Peter, you know, oral diarrhea. You know, who, having nothing to say, said? You go down that list, and I tell you, that's the most exciting mix. Greatest mistakes I ever made in choosing people in a process of discipleship is that I would always pick people like me. I mean, after all, these are discerning people. That's a laughter of identification. You know, they appreciate my ministry. They must be discerning. And I think some of the most profitable groups I have ever been in, at the student level as well as at the lay level, and with a group of pastors I'm working with right now, is that we got a mix that won't quit. And that's the beauty of it, because that's what the body's all about. I don't know what your experience is, but I can tell you in the seminary we have set no track record for picking the winners. We give more awards to more individuals we're still looking for. You know, and if some guy walks across the thing and everybody, who is it? Was it? Oh, yes, congratulations. You know, he goes out here in Goonie Land and the Church of Immaculate Perception and man, he gets himself involved, and man, it's all out of sight. We love to hear that. It's one of our products. That's why when a person asks me, one of your students, I say, how's he doing? Very well. He's my student. Not doing well? Never heard of him. I want to give you one final suggestion on this. Will you stop pressuring people into discipleship groups? Man, we're paying a high cost for that. You know, the person starts to wince a little bit and wiggle out of it. Oh, that's all right. We'll make it easier. Did you ever discover in the life of Jesus Christ how many times he told people to go home? See, we never tell anybody to go home. Oh, don't leave. My shattered nerves. Too hard? Sorry. We'll make some exceptions. See, the disciples came and said, hey, Lord, they're all taking off on you. He says, good. Maybe you should go too. I said, oh, Lord,
To whom shall we go? You got the words of eternal life.
I'm still trying to develop enough courage to do this at Dallas Seminary, but I have a strong urge someday to get up in chapel and say, okay, men, we're going to draw a line right down the center of the chapel. And those of you who want to play games, go over here. And those of you who want to go for broke, go over here. Because you see, many times we have never faced people with the challenge of investing their life without a string attached. So they come to a seminary having never made the most basic decisions involved in committed discipleship. Fourth, allow enough developmental rope for people to grow. Allow enough developmental rope for people to grow. Now, let me draw you just a little chart that shows you something of the process. And by the way, this is something that those of us who are deeply involved in the Navigators are still trying to work out. And it's very interesting because I'm spending a lot of time with people who are doing some research in this area, and we still have not come to grips with everything. So don't think we've got it all together. I'm asking you some questions that you need to ask yourself. You see, in the early phases of discipleship, you need more structure. You need some rails on which a person can move. But if you have too much structure, you develop passive, dependent people. And we don't know a whole lot about leaders, but there's one thing we know. They're not passive, and they are not dependent in the sixth sense. And we tend to develop in our evangelical seminaries, particularly, and in our churches, a group of passive dependents. People who are scared spitless to do anything different, even if Jesus Christ tells them to do it. That's why you guys latched on to what Joe was talking about the other day. Because, you know, deep down in your heart, you're saying, man, I wish I had the guts to commit myself to something that I was convinced Jesus Christ wanted me to do, even though everybody else in the evangelical community is going in the opposite direction. Because we get more of our security from the evangelical community than we get from Jesus Christ. But somewhere along this line, and this needs to be sort of a jagged line, we need to move into the realm of more creativity, in which there is more freedom and people are encouraged to make decisions and commitments on their own. If not, what you do is cripple them emotionally and spiritually. Now, one of the reasons I love to come to the Glen, and there are 16 dozen reasons, is that, as you know, the name means the Glen of the Eagle. And I am a favorite student of birds. And to me, the most fascinating of the birds is the eagles, because it's the greatest of the trainers. One of the National Rangers, some years ago, I spent 4 days out in the wilderness of this great country with him, studying eagles. And as you know, these eagles build these massive nests. You can see one right down on your way out, up on the side of that massive rock on Razorback. These huge things with these big sticks in there. If you ever look down and see one closely, they're very jagged. And the mother, prior to the birth of the eaglets, comes along and takes down out of her breast and just lines that thing. And it just becomes like a piece of glass. And these little eaglets come and hatch out. They're so comfortable. It's so womb-like. And then pretty soon, mother, father goes up on the side of the things and starts flapping the pinions. The little thing, you know, moving out. So finally, they get the thing developed to the place. And before long, get it up there and bang, kick it out. And the little thing goes, whoa! And at the right moment, the mother, father just swoops under that with those wings and brings it back up.
puts it back on the edge and then puts the huge talon around it, the huge wing around it, and just hugs it. They have put sensors on those things, and those little eaglet's hearts are at the breaking point, just almost to explode. And when she finally gets the thing till it's comforted again, bang! Out it goes again. Till ultimately it doesn't return. Let me ask you, when's the last time you did that to somebody? I'm going to share something with you. You promise you won't tell anybody? You promise? If you don't promise, I'm going to tell you. We sat around a table as a faculty, 50 of us. It's graduation time. We got a guy coming up. One of the faculty says, "You got to be kidding. We're not graduating him, are we?" Well, his name is up here. So we go around the circle. Anybody around these tables can recommend this guy for ministry? Answer, no one. Then what in the world are we graduating him for? I'm going to share something with you. You promise you won't tell anybody? You promise? If you don't promise, I'm going to tell you. We sat around a table as a faculty, 50 of us. It's graduation time. We got a guy coming up. One of the faculty says, "You got to be kidding. We're not graduating him, are we?" Well, his name is up here. So we go around the circle. Anybody around these tables can recommend this guy for ministry? Answer, no one. Then what in the world are we graduating him for? Whereupon, having more guts than brains, I intruded the question, who of us has told him about this? Answer, no one. Then the problem is not his. It's ours. I'm working right now with 5 different Christian leaders, prominent, most of whose names you know, who are in the process of getting a divorce. And the interesting thing is, we move in on these situations, we'll go around and say to a guy who's his assistant, guy that's his closest friend in the church, guy that played golf with him every week, "Did you know about that?" "Well, yeah, I know, Hendricks, they were having troubles there." So let me ask you one question. "Did you ever say anything?" "Oh, I say it in love, my dear brothers in Christ. We are developing a collection of chickens who really do not know that the New Testament teaches the importance of admonishing and rebuking and exhorting." And you see, many times what happens is we're just helping push the guy over the cliff. The greatest change in my whole life in ministry came when a guy in Wheaton College, mind you, at the end of 4 years, called me into his office, told me to sit down, reamed me out, read me the riot act. Every time I opened my mouth, he told me to keep it shut. And when I went out of that place, I was the hottest person you have ever seen. Until about 3 days later, when I cooled down, I said, "I found the first person in 22 years who loved me enough to tell me my greatest problem." You see, we've got a fakey, certainly unbiblical concept of love. Sometimes you've got to hurt in order to heal. Now, I'm not talking about getting together with a group and say, "All right, now the first job is to level." And we see how many we can crucify in 5 minutes. No, I'm talking about building a relationship so that you earn the right to rebuke a person. Fifth, expose people to a variety of gifted individuals. I'm sure at this stage of the game in your life and ministry, you are aware that you are not God's gift to everyone. If you have a hard time choking that down, take it by faith. And that's the hardest thing for some pastors to learn. By the way, that's why If you see a church that has a team ministry, I'm talking about 2, 3, 23 people working together harmoniously as a team, if you ever see it, you know you are looking at a miracle. You are looking at a phenomenon. And it's a very simple reason, and that is, you know, we're talking a better game than we're playing. We talk about spiritual gifts, but we don't function that way. So if my youth director ministers to a group of people that I can't touch with a 20-foot pole, and people start coming up to me and saying, "Hey, Pastor, man, that guy is fantastic. That's the greatest guy we got on the staff." I say, "Oh, yeah." And that's why some of you need to be freed up to the fact that your wife will have a greater ministry in your assembly than some of you. See, my wife ministers to students at the seminary. I'm not talking about wives. I'm talking about men that I can't even touch. Now, if you are a highly insecure and threatened individual, really a mark of your spiritual immaturity, then you have a hard time choking it down. I don't want to expose people. And I've had pastors tell me, I mean, mind you, tell me that when I invite somebody to come in, when I'm going to be away for a vacation, I bring somebody who can't preach as well as I can, so that when I come back, they appreciate what they got. And you know, that's, boy, that's a third Thessalonians expression. See, the problem with this business of only having one-on-one is the danger of limiting the people you are working with by your own limitations. These students come to me all the time and say, "Hey, Rob, I got preaching. I'm gonna get with that discipleship stuff." "Oh, great, good. What are you planning to do?" "Well, I'm going to do what Jesus did." "Well," I said, "that's wonderful. What did Jesus do?" "Well, you know, he built into a life handful of guys." I said, "Great. Are you Jesus?" "Of course not." "Well," I said, "then you better be very careful about trying to do what he did." See, I happen to believe that Jesus Christ had all of the gifts. I also happen to believe you don't. And every one of you has experienced this. In fact, that's the key to good leadership, when you don't care who gets the credit. See, but if you're all bent out of shape because somebody gets the credit, I'll never forget a dear old saint, old Presbyterian minister, Manigai, taught me more about walking with Jesus Christ and serving in a practical way. Dear guy, pray over me every day. He just lean over me like a Hulk and pour out his heart to God for me. And one day I said to him, "Hey, man, how have you been so successful?" I'd sit in session meetings, and man, this guy would, he was beautiful to watch into action. And most of the time he wasn't really that active, and yet the whole job was getting done. And he said, "Well," he said, "son, I learned many years ago, never bring up an idea in a session meeting." I said, "No, you don't think so?" "No." He said, "Share it with the number of elders as you're going out the door. 6 months later, they'll bring it up as their own idea. But never identify it as yours. Just get into the discussion, give a little opposition, it'll go right through." See, it's amazing what you can do. Wouldn't you care? You don't care who gets the credit. So I pour out my guts to my students and I share with them everything I know. And then, you know, there's some visiting firemen come through. And I say, "Hey, man, come on into my class." "Sure." So he comes in and he gets up and he shares, you know, the same thing I've been telling them. And the students come up and say, "Boy, Prof, that's fantastic. Never heard that before." You know, it's a real test of your being able to say, "Isn't that exciting? Isn't that thrilling? Did you hear that? Yeah, Prof, it's tremendous. And another thing he said." See, because what difference does it make who gets the credit when you go home and you get some significant discipleship going. The ultimate question is, are we getting the job done? Well, I'm resisting temptation. Let me give you a sixth. And it's going to be very convicting. I don't mean for you, I mean for me. This is the number one problem I face. Stress strong interpersonal relationships. And I would state this principle in a way that perhaps you can remember it. And that is, you will mark a person in direct proportion to your personal involvement with them. And I spent this week with a lot of you guys, laymen and pastors alike. And I kid you not, as I told you at the front end, you are some of the most significant people with a tremendous heart for God. But it's my judgment, most of you, including myself, are too far removed from the people we are trying to impact. You see, you can impress people at a distance. You can only impact them up close. You can get up in a pulpit, man, you're a gifted individual, and boy, you can scrape the Milky Way and hang one on them. But to be able to change the whole course of their life so that they are never the same again, you're probably going to have to get up a little closer. And I'll tell you what will happen. The same thing that happened to Dear Ray. He just about killed himself. Same thing that's happened to me a half a dozen times. I've been so close, I think, to somebody's psychopathic wart. Because the more you love people, the more people want you to love them. The more people are available. So we got 1,450 students on our campus. How many people do you think you can get next to? And one student came in some time ago, you know, these kids don't mind telling you what they think. And he unloaded on me, you know, Prof, you just don't spend enough time with me. Well, I said, that's true. I said, but let me just remind you of a few facts. In the first place, I've spent more time with you than 99% of the students on this campus. And I said, furthermore, who would you like me to cut out so that I can spend more time with you? To which he said, well, I guess that's kind of self-centered, isn't it? So you always let the counselee make the conclusions. That's right. Because some of you are going to go out of here, you've already shared with me, you got the picture, you got the big picture, and you're going to go back and you're going to be very successful. In fact, the very fact that you are successful is what's going to create your greatest problem. So you're always going to live in the tension. And that's why you've got to multiply the number of individuals who can do this. Let me put one other thing under that, because this is another thing that I think is surface, but that we need to nail. And that is, be sure to let people see you in a variety of settings. And most of us prefer people to see us when we got all the ducks lined up. I had some students out to my house to watch a Cowboy game not too long ago. And you have to understand, when the Cowboys come on, I froth at the mouth and fairly need to be led away. There is not a half a rational functioning cell in my brain. And so these guys are all sitting around and I'm yelling my head off. And I come down and I bang my hand against the thing like this and the wristwatch goes boom all over the place. And it was so quiet there. And I looked around, and they're all... And one guy afterwards said to me, you know, Prof, I knew you were an excited person, but I didn't know you had the disease that bad. This is what most pastors are scared to death about. They're scared that somebody's going to find they're human. So they spend all of their time protecting themselves, keeping people at a distance where you don't find, you know, that I have a problem of depression, that I'm so discouraged. I was in an elders meeting not too long ago with a young guy in the church doing a fantastic job. Fantastic. In fact, the elders in the church are just out of their trade. One of them said to me, man, if we could have one half of the marriage that kid's got, we'd consider we were making significant progress. Right in the middle of the meeting, he just broke down. He said, man, I can't carry it anymore. I can't do it. And that precipitated the discussion. The best thing that ever happened in the church is one of the elders said, well, that's not his problem, that's our problem. We need to be sharing what he's carrying. But you see, if you're trying to keep them impressed, you got everything together, then I really think this is one reason why we communicate so little in our preaching. Because most people say, well, you know, he lives in a different realm. You know, the pastor, he comes down from heaven on Sunday morning and goes back Sunday night. I say, really? Why don't you talk to his wife? I love that story. I thought Ray was going to tell it this morning. You know, the dear gal that said to the pastor going out, man, you've got to be one of the great men of this generation. She gets out in the car with her husband and he says, you know, sweetheart, lady said, I'm one of the great men of this generation. He said, I wonder how many great men there are in this generation. She said, I don't know, but one less than you think. That's why every man needs a good wife, man. Just good hat pin. Here's the seventh one. Magnify a person's roles, not his gifts. Magnify a person's roles. Will you please spell that correctly? It's R-O-L-E-S. Keep getting papers back with R-O-L-L-S. And I want to share just a seed that I'd love to see you guys do some thinking about. It's my judgment that your objective is not to help people determine their gifts, but to develop the person. Now, the concept of spiritual gifts is very contributory, but it's got us off on a sidetrack. And we got all kinds of people in the body who are immobilized, sitting around waiting for God to stick them with a javelin, or set down a sheet out of heaven like he did for Peter and said, rise, kill, take the gift. I think gifts are discovered in the process of usage. And I think, and I want to share something with you, and you guys who are laymen need to support your pastors in this kind of thing, is that the average pastor comes across to the layman, they have told me, as if we would like you to come to our church to help me pull off what I want to pull off. And it really doesn't wash. Instead of a layman coming in and we communicate to him, we want to help you accomplish what you think God wants you to do with your life. Think of the difference that would make. So instead of getting a person into the church and the first thing we do is to press them into the harness and get all this burnout that we've got today, we need to say, look, we want to minister to you as a person, as a husband, as a father, as a businessman. And then out of that will come his ministry. See, we wiped out one of the wealthiest men in the city of Dallas who came to faith. Guy was so committed, so turned on. Man, he gave his money without a string attached. Every Christian organization in the community backed up, you know, for obvious reasons. Guy was so generous, he just gave hours and hours of his skills and his time till we wiped out his family and we wiped out his marriage. And it's the greatest travesty in the community of Dallas today because we never ministered to him as a person. And I think you will make a tremendous contribution to people if you make the switch. Eight, cultivate their faith. A student taught me this by asking me a question. He came up after class one day and said, "Prof, what in your judgment is uppermost in the mind of Jesus Christ and the training of the 12? Well, I said, "That's a profound question. I'm going to have to think about it." And I have been thinking about it ever since. But I think I've come up at least to my own satisfaction with an answer. The thing that was uppermost in the mind of Jesus Christ in the training of his 12 was the cultivation of their faith. By the way, that's the only thing he ever rebuked them for. Never rebuked them because they didn't have their sandals shine, because they didn't have their toga tucked in. You know, all the other Mickey Mouse things that we sometimes get involved in. He just said, "How is it that you, emphatic, of all people, have no faith?" Now, I'll tell you what this will do to you. This will force in your mind the searching question, are you a man of faith? Because it is very difficult to reproduce when that's not your kind. And I've got a group of students who've got my backs to the wall right now. They are really challenging my faith. And I'm taking some giant steps right now, I must confess. Because they are believing God for some impossible things. And I've been getting just a little too cautious. You know, after all, I don't want to drop a watermelon here. You know, when you get to this age, very easy to slide for home. They just won't let me. That's why I love that Hebrews 13:7 passage. Don't you, Seth, don't you love that one? Remember your leaders who spoke the word of God to you. Consider the outcome of their way of life and imitate what? What? Not their methods. And you know, I have the hardest time with this, with students. Because they want to be like you. You know, and they're constantly running around and they find out you do this, so, you know. They do that. And one guy came up to one of my students when he did this one day and he said, "Don't you have any handkerchief?" Beautiful. Do you ever see this little thing right here? See this? Little squiggly. Every time I write, I do this. I don't know why. Don't even have an intelligent reason. I just do it. I go up on the board. You can always tell my students because they'll get up, write something on the board. And... you know, one day I said to myself, "Did I ever tell you to do that?" "To do what?" "To do this?" "No, I didn't even know I did it." Isn't that interesting? Because I've been telling them to do all kinds of things, none of which they do. And in almost 30 years of teaching in seminary, I never told a guy to do that, and they do that. That's the answer. See, that's what you communicate. Not what you tell them, but what you are. So I'm asking myself, as I'm asking you, are you a man, a woman of faith? Ninth and last. Develop an incurable confidence in God's ability to change and use people. Develop an incurable confidence in God's ability to change and use people. That's one of the great reasons why I'm glad God put me in a seminary. For 30 years I've been watching this happen. And I cannot believe it to this day. Except that someone asked me in an interview some time ago, if you had to boil it down to one thing that constitutes the success of a teacher, what would it be? I said, an incurable confidence in God's ability to change that person. So if you don't believe that, then you'll never feed it to him. You'll never trust him to do it. You're going to hog the show all the way. I don't know if it's ever occurred to you what goes through the mind of a professor before a class begins, but I'll tell you. There are many times before that bell rings and we start, I look down and I see a guy and I say, "Ooh, I wonder what God will do with him." I had one of those a number of years ago that God turned my life around with. This was a guy who slept through most classes. He might as well have slept through all of them. How he graduated, I'll never know. Some of our students graduate magna cum laude. Others graduate laude outcome. This guy's in the last classification. He takes a church in Canada. A church that 26 men walked away from as hopeless. And when he took it, I thought, well, par for the course. He doesn't know enough not to take it. He moves into the church, and God does something in his life. See, this is what we're not into. We think we're going to pull this off. What a deception. You know how it happened? He had a guy call him up one day and said, "Pastor, my wife was just killed in an automobile accident. And my three children. And I wonder if you'd come over and pray with me." And he said, I hung up the phone and said, "My God, what am I going to do? I don't have anything to give this guy." And he delayed it as long as he could. It was embarrassing, he told me. Until finally he knew he couldn't put it off anymore and he went over. And instead of him ministering to this bereaved father, the father ministered to him. And God used that to move into that kid's life and turn him every way but loose. And everywhere I go, I hear about him. The place was packed. People were coming to Christ like it was going out of style. He is building a church in, you know, Canada. You can't do anything up there. That's what a lot of people will tell you. Ultra-conservative, you know, it doesn't happen up here, down here with you Yankees. But, you know, up here, God doesn't work up here like that. So, God never heard that. He just went out and worked. And I'd say, "You got the right guy? Spell it." You know, Dallas graduate? Yeah, right. So one day he wrote me, he said, "Hey, Prof, I understand you're coming up here in our area. Would you do me a favor?" I said, "Sure. What do you want me to do?" He said, "Would you speak for me? I'm going to be out of town." I said, "Certainly. I'd love to come and see what's happening." So I went, and I spoke in this place, a 125-year-old church with a building program, the first in 125 years. In fact, when he came in, it was smaller than when it was first organized. Tremendous progress. The place was so packed that when I got up, I gave my seat to a guy. He said, "By the way, have you ever heard our preacher preach?" I just couldn't screw up the courage to tell him I taught him. But you know, I came back to the seminary with a new lease on life. I repeat, we have no track record in evangelicalism for picking a winner. And I'm here to tell you, you're going to get involved in this process with some people that to you are going to impress you as if they're in the algebraic minus quantity. And you know, someday you're going to go and you're going to, you know, "Lord." And someday God's going to move into their life and he's probably going to use you as a part of the process. And someday he will rise up and call you blessed. Because you were the person that changed the whole course of his life. I just want you to know, gentlemen, that if I die in the next few weeks, months, I'm not planning on it, you understand me. But if I do, I just want you to know you have seen a fulfilled man. And I'm not talking about a person who didn't make mistakes. God knows I could never say that. You are looking at a fulfilled man. And I would say my greatest fulfillment has not come because I am a chairman of a department in a leading evangelical seminary. And my greatest fulfillment has not come because I've written books and made tapes and films and all that other stuff. My greatest fulfillment has come in building into the life of some people and seeing their life supernaturally changed by God's grace. And I just long with all of my heart to see you have that fulfillment. That's my prayer for you.